Good afternoon. You're listening to the Emily Rooney Show. Former state treasurer and one-time gubernatorial candidate Tim Cahill has broken his silence one day after State Attorney General Martha Coakley announced that he's been indicted on corruption charges. Coakley claims that ads paid for by the state lottery were, in fact, thinly disguised promotions for his gubernatorial campaign. This morning, Cahill defended the use of the ads.
It was entirely appropriate and legal for the lottery to run its ads in response to the Republican Governors Association's attacks on the integrity of the lottery. It was the right thing for them to do. Knowing what I knew then, and even what I know today, we'd do it again because it was the right thing to do. And again, I would just ask you to please respect my privacy. I'm no longer a public official. My family's privacy, my neighbor's privacy. We will fight these charges and do whatever we have to do to clear my name and my reputation.
Cahill was speaking in front of his Quincy home this morning. He appeared tired and emotional. Joining me here in the studio are Pam Wilmot, Executive Director of Common Cause Massachusetts, and Glenn Johnson of Boston.com. He's the political editor there. Glenn, I got the impression that this came as a complete, utter, and total shock to Tim Cahill. This investigation started right then and there. It started in the fall of 2010 when those ads started running because they were told to pull them. The Attorney General's office told them to pull them off. So he knew that this was a possibility, but I don't think he ever thought criminal charges were going to be brought.
Well, I don't know if he did. I think there's always a shock to the idea that you're indicted, that you face a felony charge, and that the news of that puts reporters back out on your front yard again. But we've been picking up word that some of his co-defendants were in there trying to cut deals, that there's been regular activity in this case. And so if he was really surprised yesterday, I think it's more the fact that what was a long shot campaign had descended into a felony charge, not so much that this actually had come to fruition, because there were a lot of warning signs of it over the last few months.
Pam, what's your feeling about the charges in general? There's a lot of discussion going on that everybody does this, and they're likening it to things like having the name of a governor or a mayor on a welcome to my state or welcome to my city on personal property when the state attorney or secretary of the state lists, you know, property that's has unclaimed property, that if his name is attached to that, it's the same as an advertisement. Is this in another category into itself?
This is somewhat in a different category, and there are certainly similarities. And I think that all the politicians that do these kinds of activities are going to have to take a little closer look about the expenditures and really examine them. We're not going to get away from the benefits of incumbency. The names are there. The photos are going to be there. But in this case, we have smoking guns. And we have staffers that turned over private emails that talk about their rationale for why they ran the ads. And the rationale was not about promoting government services. It was about promoting a campaign.
Or counterattacking the Republican Governors Association ads, which Tim Cahill, his lawyers, and his people claim were a direct attack on the lottery and that it caused an assault on the lottery. They claim that it actually caused a dip in lottery sales. I'm not sure if that's true.
But yeah.
Would you not buy a lottery ticket because the RGA was running an ad against it? Excuse me. I agree with Pam. I think the difference here is that there's documentable evidence, not just of somebody trying to promote a politician, but taking this money and using it in a campaign context. You know, Carmen Durso is on Ortiz is on television right now with an ad that shows her in a Medicare context. Bill Galvin is constantly
television. Does it all the time.
Promoting different aspects of his office, always with him walking around. Tim Cahill was not even in these ads, but it would almost be negligence on Martha Coakley's part if she didn't follow up on this, because she's got real prima facie evidence of a discussion about using this money for political purposes and not for public interest purposes.
All right. I'm also joined on the phone now by Peter Ubertasio. He's the director of the Joseph Martin Institute for Law and Society. Welcome. At Stonehill College, I should say, Peter. Welcome. You've been listening to us. What's your take on this?
Well, I think that the emails are really problematic for the former treasurer. But I'm very concerned about the impulse to criminalize political activity that is common, even political activity that we may dislike. There are plenty of opportunities to handle this through the messiness of the political process. And the voters of Massachusetts, in their wisdom, looked at Cahill's candidacy. These charges were raised, these ads were run, rather, during the campaign, and he finished an embarrassing third. I'm a big fan of letting the political process handle this rather than hauling these folks off to court. And there are other remedies for this as well, rather than indictments and alleging criminal activity.
Well, the fact that he was forced to take them down, was that a remedy?
Well, it is a remedy. And if the legislature is so incensed by these kinds of activities, they can do something about it short of hauling these people into court.
It also seems that at this point, Tim Cahill is no longer a public official. He lost that campaign back in November of 2010, so it's been 18 months since he's been in the public arena. Is this really worth it?
Well, I don't think it's worth it, quite frankly. I think this is a small issue. In my mind, it was settled when voters went to the ballot box and a new treasurer was elected. And I don't quite frankly see, I mean, I understand the emails, but what I'm wondering is, will politicians be more careful about putting their name and face on these kinds of ads, or will they simply be more careful about the emails they have their staffers send to each other about why they're doing it?
His name and face was not on that ad. That's
well,
the
that's
interesting
right.
part
but
about it.
The current state treasurer has his face on the abandoned properties list, you know, as was just pointed out regarding the Secretary of State, who's become quite common with comical or semi-comical ads trying to get people to vote. I mean, I think that we need to be very careful here about indictments and criminal allegations over what politicians have done. It's not an excuse for shameless behavior, but there are other remedies.
You know, one of the interesting things about this case is that Tim Cahill himself is sort of the one who prompted this, because he wrote a lawsuit against his former campaign staffers, feeling that they might share, you know, internal documents with the Baker campaign because they had defected from his, and he went after them. And sure enough, they did share stuff, but not as he feared. So if he hadn't done that, this all might not have come out. Is that true, Glenn?
Absolutely. I mean, I was flipping back through the clips yesterday, just recalling that tumultuous period. I mean, it was a Thursday and Friday in September when John Weaver and John Yob were let go. And then the next day, the campaign manager, Adam Meldrum, was fired. And it wasn't just a week later that Paul Lascoco, Tim Cahill's running mate, quit and went and endorsed Charlie Baker. That was in a span of a week. And I remember a news conference that Tim Cahill had at his headquarters in Quincy, you know, where he vowed to fight on. And you just have to wonder if in this case, this champion wrestler, this Quincy fighter, this mentality of going after these staffers after he had purged them from his campaign actually was counterproductive, because it raised all this fresh evidence of his own questionable activity. And, you know, he's going to come out of this campaign having given up a safe seat as state treasurer, having lost this quixotic campaign for governor, and now facing felony charges to be perp walked into court tomorrow morning. It's not really a great bargain.
I agree. And just to speak to a couple points that were made earlier, I don't think getting somebody out of office is an answer to some of these issues that are raised in the case. Using public resources for political purposes is a serious problem, and it may be pervasive. And there are lines. I mean, I think there are lines which he crossed. How this is going to play out in court, I think is very questionable. I really don't know what's going to happen. But I think it is entirely appropriate for it to be raised, for Martha to bring this, and let's see how it goes.
I mean, but it seems to me that the Attorney General is really going to be forced to prove motive here, because
yes,
when you look
absolutely.
At the ads themselves, they appear to adhere to the letter of the law. He is not in them. His name is not mentioned in them. It's a pushback against these Republican governor's ads, which they spent, what was it, $2.3 million mm-hmm. in this state mm-hmm. attacking Tim Cahill and his management of the lottery. And so, you know, they're claiming that the timing, that it's all just coincidental, that the money they got, that they didn't even have their advertising budget until July. So, you know, it took them a while to get the plan in place, and then they just started running these ads right after they produced them.
There's a couple things that are going to work against Tim Cahill in this, and there's a couple things that are going to work against Martha Coakley in this. I mean, he's the first statewide official to be indicted in a half century. And part of what's working against him is there's such an electronic trail to this whole thing. There's not just these personal email accounts which show some evidence to conceal what you're doing, but there's also text messages which are from registered cell phone to registered cell phone. So there's a direct connection there. There's also just the language that's in these emails. And then you have the potential for Martha Coakley to prove these crimes. You know, Tim Cahill is going to fight his way back in this, and he's going to show those ads by Bill Galvin, those ads
yes.
by Carmen Ortiz. And if anything, it's going to be, I think, have the potential to shake up the whole establishment. You know, talking about how this is pervasive is true, but at one point, does it stop, you know, or is it pulled back a little bit? I mean, here you had a guy engaged in an alleged conspiracy to spend public money to benefit his campaign, and they have documentable proof of it, allegedly. If you turn a blind eye to that, I mean, where are you ever going to draw the line down the road? So,
yeah, we're going to speak to that, Peter, because even though this may seem like small potatoes in some quarters, I mean, it could become it is pervasive. It could become. It is.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that and that's part of the issue. And I agree. It's really very complicated because we certainly have an expectation that politicians use their public office to assist in their own reelections, and they have done that forever because it is their number one priority to either be reelected or elected to a new office. And of course, they do, in the best possible light, they do represent the offices to which they've been elected, and it can be very hard to divorce their political goals with the goals of the office that they serve, which is, I think, the complication. In this case, his argument is that he had a group taking direct aim at the integrity of the lottery, and that they were simply responding, and that they didn't do it with his image and they didn't do it with his name. That's going to be very different than what Bill Galvin does with the Secretary of State's office and the emails notwithstanding. And so I think it's going to be very complicated. I guess my larger concern is what I wonder is will we feel like justice has been served in this case if, given the dollar figure and what happened to his political career, Tim Cahill ends up going to jail as a result.
Well, that is the bottom line to this. I mean, and I've got everybody to weigh in on this, on whether this should be criminalized in the way it is. I mean, a felony, you know, state corruption, when really what he was doing is sort of following a pattern of what – it isn't like he was peeling off money from some fund and stuffing it in his pocket or stuffing it into the coffers of his campaign. He was doing something that was kind of part of a well-established pattern that politicians in this state anyway have done for decades. And so to be tarred for life, even if he's acquitted for life, have been indicted.
But the reason this is a felony charge is because people were outraged with other ethics violations and the legislature changed and moved this stuff from civil infractions to criminal infractions. And so, you know, at some point, you know, people have to, you know, bear the consequences of the outrage that they've expressed before. And the stuff that sort of went from Tom Finneran and Charlie Flaherty to Sal DeMacy, Brian Wallace, all these other characters, Diane Wilkerson, Chuck Turner – you know, at some point, you know, that prompted a change in the ethics laws, and Tim Cahill is now the first person to be prosecuted under them.
And you have to prove fraudulent intent. It isn't a matter of just doing it. You have to prove that intent. So that is a fairly high bar, but there is evidence out there that that intent existed, and that's going to be the case that the state is going to have to make. So I think they do have a burden, but there is a line, and we're exploring where that line is.
Sorry to Pam Wilmot from Common Cause, Glenn Johnson, who's the political editor of Boston.com, and Peter Ubertasio, he's the director of the Joseph Martin Institute for Law and Society at Stonehill College. I mean, does this case deserve jail time, though? I think that's it. that's what we're all coming down to. It's like, really?
Well, almost all of the ethics in the campaign finance law, actually the campaign finance laws, are only criminal. That includes not reporting a contribution. You know, should somebody go to jail because they don't report a contribution? But that is the criminal statute. So just because something is a criminal statute doesn't necessarily mean that justice would be served for them to be locked up for 5 years. So It doesn't bother me that it's a criminal statute. I think if you have fraudulent intent, that is appropriate. How a jury hears the case, how it plays out, I think is again a different story.
But I mean, a civil charge would basically do the same thing. I mean, he's going to be fined no matter what. I mean, what do you think of that, Peter?
Well, I mean, I think that's right. Of course, you know, you can't go back and change the law now. I mean, and so I think Pam is quite right when she said we're sort of testing the boundaries here and testing the meaning of what constitutes fraudulent intent. And it may very well be that that this goes to trial and the court comes back and concludes that this was not fraudulent intent. And so at the end of the process, he may have been damaged. I don't think that he will be wounded for life as a result of an indictment, as distasteful as that is. But we'll have a much better sense of what constitutes fraudulent intent at the end of this process.
You know, I think one thing that that Tim Cahill and his lawyers might have going for them in this context is that, unlike all the other examples we've used, the lottery is a business. I mean, you could say that the city of Boston is an entertainment, and you know the lost property list is a public service, but this is a business. And this lottery is competing with every other form of entertainment imaginable in the state. So once that lottery was under attack by the Republican Governors Association, they felt that the urgent need to jump on it, which is meaning not to wait until November or December when they normally would run these ads, because I guess I didn't realize this, but more people buy lottery tickets around the holidays. I'm not sure why that is. But
you've never gotten a stocking stuffer, obviously.
No, I'm not a big lottery person at all. I mean, I think it's, you know, and facts bear me out. It's a poor person's tax.
You know? Absolutely.
It's 40% of the people. There was a statistic yesterday. I think maybe Franny can send that to me. I think something like 40% of the tickets are bought by people who make less than $30,000 or something. It's really, I mean, we're in the legalized gambling business. I understand that. But I think it's, you know. I wish we could figure out another way to make some money, some revenue for the state. And I don't think the gambling thing is going to do it either. But as I said, it's not going to affect me.
You know what's interesting, too, from this whole thing is there's a supreme irony in this whole thing. Martha Coakley yesterday stood up at the podium and talked about charges against Tim Cahill for using public resources to advance his political career. And now Martha Coakley, who's faced criticism for not prosecuting state officials, is going to try Tim Cahill with some risk or benefit to her own political career here. You know, there's a lot of people talking about her as a potential gubernatorial candidate herself a couple of years down the road, and how this case comes off or not, you know, could have some bearing on that. So it's just interesting to me from a purely political voyeuristic aspect that a trial against Tim Cahill for, you know, abusing his office or using his office for political purposes is going to, you know, have that same kind of challenge or a benefit potentially for Martha Coakley here.
That's a good point. That she could, especially if she doesn't win this case, you know, people could charge that she used all these public resources chasing a case that wasn't worth it.
Well, they can, and I'm sure they will, depending on the outcome. But any government activity could be viewed through that lens for buying the election.
A waste
official.
Of money.
Either a waste. No, a politician using their office to do a particular thing, which, you know, you can say is a waste of money, isn't a waste of money, is being used to bolster your career or not. In this case, it's really about, was there an intent to cross that line between political and public, and was it covered up? And was there any real public benefit from those ads? And
that,
I think that's
these emails are so problematic. Yeah. I mean, everybody talks about, you know, the RGA was assaulting the lottery, and so that's fine. If there's a bunch of emails saying the RGA is assaulting the lottery and revenues are dropping, we need to respond. That would be fine, I would think. But there's a bunch of emails saying we just got numbers back from a focus group and your leadership of the lottery is your prime calling card and running for governor. We got to get an ad up, and we have another $1 million in lottery ad money to do it.
I'd like to see that focus study. Have you seen it?
No, but I mean, Martha Coakley talked about it yesterday. She said in July of 2010 there was a focus group, and that was the impetus for this. And she was very specific about how it was on X day and on Y day this happened. So you got to think that she's got that evidence. I mean, she knows the tightrope she's on here too, and she better not whiff on this one. So you would think that she would have it nailed down.
I would like to see it because I think they're denying that the lottery was anything had anything to do with that focus group. But you know, I don't know what it was.
No,
one
a
of
campaign
those...
focus group, though. I think it was what she was talking about.
Yeah, a campaign focus group.
Yeah,
and whether the lottery was because sometimes those focus groups are conversations it records. Sometimes they're hardcore Q&A type questions and other things that are prompted. I mean, I don't know whether they have a videotape of that or.
You think about, too, another fascinating political angle to this whole thing. I mean, you have these John McCain veterans come riding into town to help Tim Cahill mount this independent candidacy, and they leave with a bunch of knives in his back, and then they go on, and they then go on and run John Huntsman's campaign, and Mary Kay Huntsman now hates their guts, too. And
these are all the same people.
Yeah. And you see tweets out yesterday, which was fascinating. Another thing to watch in this whole case was how the Cahill family responded through Twitter. And you see Tim Cahill's wife, Tina, talking about her affinity for the Huntsmans because she equally regrets associating with these former McCain advisors who took a lot of money out of both of these campaigns, and they both ended up in the side of the road at the end of it, and with some consequence now for Tim Cahill here.
All right. Peter, any final thoughts on this?
Well, I would say that I think you've nicely encapsulated the issue regarding fraudulent intent. If they could have used campaign money to bolster his candidacy and chose instead to use taxpayer money, that's going to be a very, very big problem for him. But for her, for the attorney general, I'd say that Massachusetts political history is littered with attorneys general who thought that they could use their office to advance upward, and they almost all fail to do so. And one reason, I think, is because prosecutors' offices run very differently.
Yeah.
She's not only taking on Tim Cahill, she's taking on a practice that many politicos use. And so if she is successful, I don't think she's going to make many friends among the establishment Democrats in the state who she'll need to launch another campaign.
Okay. Peter Ubertasio from Stonehill College, thanks so much. My thanks also to Pam Wilmot from Common Cause and Glenn Johnson, political editor of Boston.com. Thanks so much. When we return, we're going to be talking about that Supreme Court ruling that allows officials to strip search people arrested for minor offenses. And I just want to – this was that lottery statistic I was telling you about. As it turns out, people making less than $13,000 a year spend 9% of their money on lottery tickets. That's the statistic came out following the Mega Millions jackpot earlier this week. Under $13,000 a year spending 9% of their money. That's what the lottery is good for. Okay. Listen to The Emily Rooney Show at 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. It's all Mexican man.